By 1932, Stalinism is triumphant in the Soviet Union. There is no more opposition inside the Soviet Union, so that now Stalin cannot lean first on Bukharin, and then after the terrible debacle in Great Britain during the general strike of 1926, he can no longer lean on Bukharin in the Chinese Revolution of 1927, after the debacle that took place in Shanghai, ending up in Canton and so forth. So that after the expulsion of the left opposition in 28, and the rejecting, or rather the non-submitting of their platform to the Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which was a violation, of course, of the organizational concepts of communism, and then the expulsion of the right wing following that in 1928, when the peasants finally declared war on, the kulaks declared war on the countryside by refusing to deliver their grains. Stalinism gradually wiped out the last remnants of, or not the last remnants, but the last mouthpieces of opposition in the right wing and the left wing of the Communist International, or the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And from thence on, is more or less on its own. But it was not until 1932-33 that the bureaucracy had consolidated itself to the extent of where all opposition inside the Soviet Union was quieted down. And there was no spokesman to oppose the bureaucracy of which Stalin was the spokesman. Now, we pointed out how Stalinism, without a program, being a centrist, politically speaking, had no program, but fluttered around from left to right, from the left wing to the right wing, and then back again to the left. And this was reflected in international politics, where he fluttered around with the British trade union fakers and the capitalist Kuomintang party in China up until 1928. And then went on a left-wing binge of the, what we call a third period. Now you see this term used repeatedly in our own press in regard to Stalinism, that Stalinism has manifested third period politics in one way or another, and we also see it applied mainly to PL. The Progressive Labor Party, that speaks with all the main manifestations of Stalinism of the third period. See, in those days, the Communist International divided the development of world events into periods, and the first period after the First World War ended around 1924 with the stabilization of capitalism, and then the second period came with the stabilization of capitalism, and the third period started in 1928 when Stalinism proclaimed the world revolution in each and every country without exception, as I said before, from the North Pole to the South Pole, and running around the equator until it ran into itself and I guess caused an atomic explosion. But the point is that in the third period, Stalinism concocted the theory of social fascism, whereby each and everybody that wasn't a member of the Communist Party was a fascist to one degree or another, and we don't have to go into that today because we explained it last week. And also that, as I said before, that revolution was on the agenda in every single country throughout the world. Well, you say, you mean in the United States, the communists really believed that revolution was on the agenda? That's right, they did. And if you have a lot of time on your hands, you can rush down to the Boston Public Library, if they keep bound files of the Daily Worker, you can get them of this period. And I'd advise you to look up the May Day, the issues around May Day of around 1933 or 4. And I remember reading the comic strip in those days in the Communist Party, an article written by Philip Frankfeldt, who was the organizer of the Communist Party in New England here, and he wrote an article how the Communist Party still holds on a Boston Common against the cowardly police. They were creating socialism not in one country, in one city, but in Boston Common. Out of this world nonsense. No, it wasn't Frankel that wrote the article. It was the guy that was before him. He afterwards got transferred to Milwaukee when the line changed. But they were lunatics just the same, both of them. They carried out the line of the Communist International to the last inch. Well, as we said before, the international line seemed to be a reflection of the internal politics in the Soviet Union. And in 1928, when the theory of socialism in one country started to be implemented, and side by side with that, the third period started to be implemented. That is social fascism. That the world revolution was on the agenda. Conditions inside the Soviet Union were reaching a revolutionary pitch by the rank and file peasants and the workers, particularly the workers. Stalinism, in order to counteract the program of the left opposition headed by Trotsky, started to put the program itself into operation. In other words, it took over the platform of the Trotskyists and put it into operation. One, collectivization, as we explained last week, instead of using state farms as an example for the rest of the peasantry, it went into the countryside, and at the point of the bayonet, tried to enforce collectivization. And it was in the Ukraine, which was the main farming center of the Soviet Union in those days, it was in the Ukraine that Khrushchev made his reputation. That's where he proved his mettle to Stalin, that he was a brute, and therefore a worthy leader of the Soviet Communist Party. He became known as the butcher boy of the Ukraine. They forced the peasants into these collectives, and the peasants answered by slaughtering their cattle, by slaughtering all their livestock, and by sabotaging planting of crops throughout the whole Soviet Union, by eating up the parts of the crops that were saved for planting the next season. And this only led to a civil war on the countryside. A civil war, not just the word civil war, but a civil war on the countryside, in which it's estimated 5 to 10 to 15 million peasants were exterminated, either on the countryside itself or in transportation to Siberia. Whole villages were transported to Siberia and resettled, as well as millions and millions of peasants starving to death in the Ukraine. Now, this was all denied, of course, by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in those days. But by 1932, this collectivization started in the middle of 29, pardon me, and by 1932, it's had its reaction. At the same time, underneath the board, Stalinism was maneuvering internationally to come to terms with Hitlerism in Germany, and at the same time maneuvering to make some kind of international alliances with capitalist countries throughout the world, underneath the board. The brutality of the collectivization on the countryside forced the peasantry into a civil war, and a destruction of the crops, and the slaughtering of its cattle. And by 1932, while Stalinism is manipulating underneath the board, trying to come to some kind of arrangements with the imperialist nations, out of a blue sky, Stalinism denounces forced collectivization. The very policy that Stalinism enforced at the point of the bayonet is now revealed by Stalin to be a mistaken policy. That some comrades were not following the policy of the party. They were forcing the peasants into collectivizations. And to show that Stalin meant business, he executed some of those that had taken his orders, or either that or they took their life in their hands. They took his orders and enforced the collectivization. In other words, Stalinism was double-dealing completely, 100%, not only against the left opposition, the right opposition, but against its own supporters, the rank and file, as well as afterwards the leadership of the Stalinist movement itself in the Soviet Union. And it was declared that in 1932, no more forced collectivizations. And many were shot for for their past actions of carrying out Stalin's orders. And along with the attack on forced collectivization came the creation of peasant setups, collectivization, collectivized farms being turned over in perpetuality, or perpetuity, whatever the term is, to the peasants in these collectives. In other words, you were creating private property, in one way or another, to those farmers and those peasants that were in these collectives. And alongside of this, a plot of land was given to each individual peasant to cultivate himself, and he had complete control of disposing of the products of that private piece of land, which led to the creation of the capitalist market again, the very thing that Stalinism said had to be wiped out in 1928. Well, the whole, as I pointed out last week, the whole result of this policy of zigzagging on the countryside resulted as follows. That in 1930, when the policy was first getting implemented, the total production on the countryside of the Soviet Union was 106 million tons of wheat. And in 1935, after the great victory of collectivization, it was reduced to 92 million. Now you say to yourself, well, how come that the members of the Communist Party couldn't see this? Well, as I explained last week, it was just like the Roman Catholic Church. Something happens and the faithful don't notice anything. That's the only way you could explain it. Now, industrially, all kinds of pressures were put on the workers. I explained last week how the only country in the world where they had socialism, where it was publicly proclaimed by law that they had socialism, was the only country in the world where the worker had to have a passport to go from one city to another, to go from one plant to another. You lived by a passport, not an international passport, but a passport inside the country. The only country in the world where the citizenry had to have a passport to move around internally. That was the great advance that they had in the Soviet Union in the early 30s. And then they had all of the whipped up propaganda encouraging the workers to produce more and so forth to create socialist society inside the Soviet Union. Stalin gave a speech in which he said, at the end of the first 5-year plan, we'll have socialism. And all the faithful said, Allah be praised, we'll have it. Well, in 1934, when they took the totals down as to production and so forth, despite all the baloney that was pumped out by the Stalinist bureaucracy, and all the propaganda that was pumped out all over the world, how they were going to complete the plan in 2 years and through two years and 6 months and 2 years and 9 months and so forth and so on, and this industry had completed their plan in 2 years and this one had completed in a year and 9 months. After all that baloney was stripped, it was found out that according to the figures of production from 1929 to 1934, the United States had gone down from 100% down to 67%. That was the year this was the period of the collapse of world capitalism. British capitalism, which had collapsed back in 1900 with the turn of the century, was up to 96%, which wasn't saying anything for British capitalism because they had a terrific unemployment problem. Germany was up to 86% of production. Already, Hitlerism had taken control of German capitalism, or was in the pay of German capitalism, rather, and they were laying the basis for the rearmament and the future World War II. French economy had collapsed in 1934 and was down to 71% production over a 5-year period. Italy was down to 80% of production over a 5-year period. But the Soviet Union, where all this brutality occurred, where all this misguidance of industrialization had taken place, where all these terrible mistakes were made by bureaucrats, which only bureaucrats can make, production was up 239% compared to 1929. This is living proof that regardless of what conditions humanity lives under, if they work collectively, they can outproduce capitalism. Under a capitalist system. Despite all the brutalities of the Soviet bureaucracy from 1929 until 1934, despite the extermination of millions of peasants, despite the extermination and deportation to Siberia of millions of workers, don't forget millions of workers were deported, despite the fact that democracy was wiped out to the last inch inside the Soviet Union, the Soviets were reduced, the party was reduced, The factory committees were reduced and so forth. The workers had absolutely no say in production whatsoever, despite all these shortcomings. Production in the Soviet Union had increased to 239%, undisputed by capitalist economists. That gives you an idea of the great potentials of socialism if you had democracy and the workers participating consciously in the planning of production. Now, of course, Stalinism blew its horn on this, and this was one of the great points that encouraged a lot of the membership in the Communist Party to remain in it. But side by side with this, we have the victory of Hitlerism in Germany through the utter betrayal of Stalinism. That is, the refusal of Stalinism to allow a united front between the Second International and the Third International. And the result was that Hitlerism came in and took over, despite the slogan that Stalinism had raised, "After Hitler, our turn," meaning that Hitler would take over the government, and then through his crazy planning of trying to rehabilitate German capitalism through forced loans and so forth, Germany would be in a terrible financial crisis, and then the workers would rally to the Communist International, lead the Second International, and rally to the Third International, and then communism would take over in Germany. It was a nice pipe dream, and you can't, in a free country, you can't shoot somebody for making crazy remarks or having crazy ideas. And up to in Germany, up till 1933, you could run around loose with all kinds of screwball ideas. And Stalinism was completely refuted by the triumph of Hitlerism, and not only that, but the rallying of the German capitalist class to Hitlerism and the implementation of German capitalism rehabilitating itself and laying the bill on the backs of the German workers, which they did. The left opposition, headed by Trotsky, said that this would create the super wrangle of German capitalism against the Soviet Union. As I said before, Wrangel was the leader of one of the counter-revolutionary armies during the Russian Civil War, and Trotsky tried to picture to the Russian workers that if this Hitlerism was victorious, it would mean a super Wrangel tackling the Soviet Union. Now James, in his book here, World Revolution, makes the statement that Stalin deliberately turned over Germany to Hitler. That's all nonsense, of course. And next week, when we summarize the Third International, we'll try to summarize Stalinism, how it degenerated and what it became from taken one step to another, and how it finally ended up as an agent an open agent of the world counter-revolution and a willing and plying tool of imperialism. Up to this time, it hadn't been that. It hadn't been that at all. It was a case of where Stalin being the spokesman for the Soviet bureaucracy, which was anti-socialist, he himself became a captive of the Russian bureaucracy, on top of the fact that he had no understanding of the mass movement, and he never had in all his life. He never took part in the mass movement, despite all the baloney that was pumped out by the Third International up to that time. He had absolutely no faith in the working class, whether it was in the Soviet Union in 1917 of March, no more than he had any faith in the German working class in 1933. He didn't know what to do, period. That's what had happened. He was terrified. And German capitalism took over, and Hitler announced the march to the East. This terrified not only Stalin, but Stalinism. That is the bureaucracy in the Soviet Union that had replaced the Revolutionary Communist Party of 1917 and 18. And Stalinism, in his search for allies, wanted to appear as a non-revolutionary, as an anti-revolutionary. And one of the attributes of a centrist is that they think they're awful clever. A centrist is an individual or a grouping inside a political party that inevitably has no program, but leans to the right and then to the left. As the working class gets into motion, strike actions, political actions, and so forth, the centrist moves to the left under the pressure of the events taking place in a country. On the other hand, if the working class suffers a defeat and there's a retreat politically, the same elements move over to the right. And they say the opposite of what they said yesterday. That's one of the features of centrism. And that's what Stalinism developed into up until 1933 and 4. While with the triumph of Hitler, Stalinism was terrified. Instead of the Communist Party taking over after Hitler has fooled around for a few months and so forth and driven the workers into the Communist Party, which was exterminated by Hitler, the Communist Party was exterminated by Hitler top and bottom, and as I pointed out last week, or the week before, there were approximately 300,000 leaders of the working class exterminated by Hitler in his concentration camps. That included members of the Socialist Party, the Communist Party, pure and simple trade unionists who were militants and so forth. So the whole German working class was beheaded. There was no chance of revolution in Germany, and the working class being betrayed was completely demoralized, and sooner or later a lot of them went over to Hitlerism under the banner of victories that Hitler was accomplishing from one country to another. Now, what's the Communist Party going to do? They can't fool around anymore with China. The Kuomintang is now under the domination of Chiang Kai-shek, an outright imperialist tool of American imperialism, still with the British having a few words in to say once in a while. German capitalism has moved away from any orbit of manipulation by rank and file citizenry, you might say. Italy is under the heel of fascism. United States doesn't recognize the Soviet Union. It isn't the big kingpin that it is today. It's a powerful country, but it plays a minor role in European politics and in world politics. It doesn't run the world the way it does. Well, Stalinism, as I said, started to fish around underneath the board, feeling out countries about what are we going to do about Hitler. Hitlerism is a scourge of mankind. It's going to wipe out humanity. It doesn't believe in democracy and so forth and so on. Well, it started to maneuver with the various capitalist countries throughout the world. And in order to show that they didn't believe in this foolishness of working class revolution and communism and so on, it made big social changes inside the Soviet Union. As I said before, the conditions in the Soviet Union were sort of a reflection of the international development of Stalinism. One of the first things it did was bourgeoisify the army. Now, as you know, Trotsky was the founder of the Red Army, and he founded it on revolutionary communist principles. That is, you can be a general and I can be a rank and file soldier, but you don't make any more dough than I do, brother. And when we get off duty, Mr. General, don't think you're any better than I am, because I'm just as equal as you are. And there's no private club for you, Mr. General. You drink in the same clubs as me and any other human beings. And don't think for one minute that when I'm off duty, I have to salute you, you punk. I respect you because you're a general and you have ability, and I voted for you to be commander-in-chief of the army and so forth and so on. But you know better than I am. In other words, the army was completely democratized. The same pay for the general as the rank-and-file soldier. There was no such a thing as saluting off-duty. There was no such a thing as private officers' clubs. You hear in the United States how they have different clubs for the officers. The officers and the nurses are all rated as officers, you know. So naturally, they can only go to bed with an officer. And there's all the rank-and-file soldiers walking around. You can imagine how they feel. Asking this, well, in the days of the World War, the sailor comers used to tell me about up in Alaska how the rank-and-file soldiers felt. Jesus Christ, they hadn't seen a woman, you know. They hadn't been in bed with a woman for months and months. And they see these nurses come along and they shack up with the officers. And the soldiers were allowed one bottle of beer a day. The officers had all the booze, you know, the hard liquor and so forth. And they used to bring it up on the ships. And they knew how much booze the officers were drinking. And the poor soldiers had one can of beer a day. Well, you can imagine how the contradiction there, that between the class contradiction, that's what it amounted to. And then Stalinism created marshals in the army. And they started to pass out the heroic badges, you know, where you see the pictures of the Russian marshals, don't you? They were all bent over like this, unless they had the weight on their back. They put a weight on their back so they could straighten up, and they have medals here, there, and there. You've seen pictures of Stalin with medals. Christ, thousands of dollars worth of metal. Then they had there was, in the days of the Red Army under Trotsky, there was complete fraternization between the army officers and the soldiers. There was no distinction off duty whatsoever. Well, that was all done away with. And to top everything, they had special schools created for the officers' children. In other words, now you were creating a caste. You were creating a section of the citizenry completely separated from the great masses of the population. Then they abolished the society of all Bolsheviks. There was a society in the Soviet Union like you have in this country, the heroic DAR, all these idiots, you know, intermarried like down in Maine or New Hampshire or Shire and Vermont, intermarried idiots from the that pride themselves on being the daughter of the American Revolution. Or I worked on a silly book this week in work, Society of Colonial Wars. You know, JVD, you know, these jerks with six initials and so forth. Important people. Morons, 90% of them. Well, in the Soviet Union, they created the Bolsheviks themselves created this organization called the Society of All Bolsheviks. They weren't the descendants of the All Bolsheviks. They were the Old Bolsheviks themselves. That was abolished by Stalin. Then there was another political organization called the Old Political Convict Association, made up of old Bolsheviks and old social revolutionaries, social democrats that had served a little term in education in Siberia, in the prisons of Tsarist Russia. That was abolished. They created a communist academy for the education of the children of the bureaucrats, so they would be separate and apart from the riffraff. Abortions were abolished by public decree. These things weren't underneath the board. These were done by public decrees. And they were in all the bourgeois papers in the United States. And as I said before, you'd say, well, how come the rank and file of the Communist Party didn't draw conclusions from this? Well, it was a religion, a pure and simple, a blind belief in Stalin, and that was all. Abortions, the right of women to bear child or not to bear child, were done away with by the laws abolishing abortions. The marriage laws were strengthened, and divorce became more or less the rule only for the bureaucrats. It was done away with as far as the working class was concerned, through the cost and so forth. And then history was written, rewritten, rewritten, and rewritten over the rewritten's, and so on. If you wish to follow this kind of development in the Soviet Union, you comrades should read the bound volumes of the Fourth International, or the New International as we called it in those days. And there you'll find everything is traced out. And John G. Wright, who was an old comrade and a Russian by birth, was the chief translator of the old man's works, and he got Pravda and so forth every day. So he wrote an amusing article one time in our magazine, in which he traced out the development of how history was written in the Soviet Union. I think he had four columns in the magazine on one page under, say, 1920, 1925, 1930, 1935, showing how an event was described in the four different editions of the history of the Communist Party. We'll say 1917, 1918. They said Trotsky was a great guy. He led the Petrograd something out. 1925, Trotsky was a president, but he didn't play much of a role. 1930, there wasn't anyone around named Trotsky. Stalin was around, and he used to give advice to Lenin. 1935, Trotsky tried to stop the revolution. He was in the pay of, well, I don't know, German, American, North Pole, Eskimos, or somebody trying to stop the revolution. And then there was a jerk named Lenin that used to run errands for Stalin while Stalin was leading the revolution. Well, you say, Jesus Christ, how the hell can they, how can the members of the CP swallow this crap? Even the bourgeois histories in the United States said that the revolution was led by two baddies named Lenin and Trotsky. They never mentioned Stalin, but these people swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. But that's how they started to adjust themselves to making a pact with the imperialists. And then, to top everything off, they brought back piecework in the factories in the Soviet Union. Now, piecework is ABC in being denounced in the socialist movement as an inhuman speed-up system. And Stalinism brought it back, and the great epitomizing of it was through a policy called Stakhanovism, which came about through this heroic coal miner in the Soviet Union named Stakhanov, who produced, I don't know, 7 or 8 million tons of coal in an hour. Silly, you know. And they told him how all the workers are looking up to Stakhanov, how they love him. Imagine the workers looking